We now move more than a century beyond the time of Saints Cyril and Ambrose to the mysterious figure called Dionysius the Areopagite, or Dionysius the Pseudo-Areopagite. Used to be called Pseudo-Dionysius, which is probably not a very good way of referring to him. We don't know exactly who he was, or even for certain where he lived, but through his writings and because of course sources whom he quotes, it's possible to determine with fair probability that he was most likely a Syrian monk and priest who wrote in Greek and who lived somewhere around the year 500 or thereabouts, not too much after that, again because of sources that we know whom he quotes, particularly Proclus. He writes under the pseudonym, under the false appellation of having been Dionysius the Areopagite, which is to say the individual whom St. Paul converted on during his visit to Athens. And we know certainly that he was not that apostolic figure, but for many centuries these writings were regarded as being of very great antiquity and possibly even of apostolic or sub-apostolic origin. The illumination on the left is a reminder of the fact that he is also the patron of Paris, or one of the patrons of Paris, in particular the patron of the Church of Saint-Denis, which was very important during the period of the reform of the Church in the Middle Ages, and was also a center of Dionysius scholarship. It was this abbey which invited the translation into Latin of many of the Greek texts of Dionysius, both during the 9th century and then later during the early Middle Ages, so as to make these texts more widely available. Like Cyril and Ambrose, this author is interested in making the ritual of the church a source of rich contemplative experience, to point out the symbolic significance of all of these things. But in his writings, he's also interested in describing the whole of creation. He writes a whole series of books casting the whole universe, and indeed all of time and space, into a framework that allows it to be seen, and this is the reason for the picture that's in the next to the illumination, as if it were a series of cascading waterfalls of grace and transformation. God at the very center or the very highest point is pouring himself out through all kinds of different levels of creation. He pours knowledge of himself into the angelic ranks. The angels become mediators, secondary pools which themselves pour out this knowledge into other ranks or parts of creation, into the sacraments which reach us, into the clergy which serve the means of allowing the sacraments to be enabled to the people, to be available to the people of God, into the whole people of God who are themselves mediators, means by which the efficacy, the power of grace, both sacramental and direct from God, reaches out to one another. So he uses quite a bit in his writings the word hierarchy, but it doesn't mean for him what it means for us. This image of the cascading waterfall, the pool of grace, is for him what a hierarchy is. It means that all grace is mediated. And when we think about it, that's true. If we know anything about love or loving, it's because we've been loved or have loved ourselves. It's through the experience that people give us that we learn of God. We learn about God literally through the ministry and the experiences that are offered to us by other people. God is using those individuals as mediators for us of knowledge of God's self. And so Dionysius is extending this into the metaphysical realm as well. All that we receive, we are receiving receiving goodness and beauty and truth and glory, which itself is being passed to us through all kinds of other levels of creation. Where he uses the word hierarchy, we could properly use the word interconnectedness. That's a very brief introduction to a very complex and difficult but profoundly beautiful and important author. I've given you here selections from two of his books, a very brief selection from The Celestial Hierarchy, his description of heaven and all the ranks of the angels. And my reason for giving it to you is very specific in this section. It's because it is in chapter 15:8 of The Celestial Hierarchy, chapter 15, book or section 8, in which he gives a mysterious interpretation to the color blue. He drops down, if we drop down to the text next to the picture of the stained glass window, he's describing the horses in Zechariah that appear again in the book of Revelation, and he tries to give a symbolic or allegorical interpretation of their color. The blue color, he says, signifies their hiddenness. And this is very important for later medieval architecture and stained glass and theory of color. The idea that blueness is the color of God's hiddenness. We might say that the glorious deep cobalt blue of the medieval cathedral stained glass windows itself became a symbol drawn from the Dionysian writings, mediated through this Abbey of Saint-Denis and the writings and practices of their very important abbot Suger. This idea that the blue is also the color of the apophatic quality of God, the blue is the hidden mystery of God, comes at least in large part in the Western tradition from a translation of this text that we have before us. If we drop down to the ecclesiastical hierarchies, I've given you, rather like what we've seen in Cyril and Ambrose, texts in which he meditates on the significance of baptism and chrismation. I warn you that his writing is not easy to read. He often creates new words to describe his metaphysical understanding. Everything for him is in triads. Everything is a movement of outpouring, number one, of indwelling, number two, and of reunion, number three. And he uses the technical terms procession, and then of abiding, and then of reunion or of theosis, of divinization. He uses this threefold movement to describe the sacraments, to describe the whole of creation. Everything is seen in light of these triads. And so much of what he does in looking at the liturgy of the church is to arrange it in this threefold way. If we drop down to his description in chapter 3 of the rite of the synaxis, which in Greek means the gathering, it's the way of referring to the Eucharist, he calls it the sacrament of sacraments, the highest mystery of all the mysteries. What does it do? And I've in the alternating gray and yellow highlights, I've indicated his basic understanding, and this applies to all the sacraments, all the what he calls sacredly initiating operations, all of these actions that are creating glory, that are transforming, they have three effects. Number one, they gather our fragmented lives into a one-like divinization. Number two, they forge a unity out of the differences within us. And number three, they bestow on us the gifts of communion and union with God, who is given here the title the One. So the Eucharist, if we drop down a little further, the Eucharist brings about a spiritual gathering for the one who receives it. It grants as a gift to us from God its perfecting capacities, and it grants us communion with God. And this is the threefold movement or action for him of the hierarchy and indeed of the whole of the spiritual life, of purification, of illumination, and of union. He'll apply this to the clerical orders, to deacon, priest, and bishop, as you see at the bottom of this text, which we're not going to have a chance to look at in detail. He applies it to the sacraments of baptism and Eucharist and Muron, of this post-baptismal chrismation, an idea that all of creation, all of grace, is an action of purification and illumination and union, and all three of these actions are occurring together, almost simultaneously. Later in the mystical tradition, much later, these will be separated out as if they were stages or steps, as we've talked about before. But here, for Dionysius, they are, as it were, three colors, three characteristics by which the divine grace operates. If we drop down to chapter 4, on which he talks about the power of psalmody, this is very beautiful. The psalms are a means of theosis. And then he gives a description of how the scriptures that are read in the liturgy are echoes of the whole of salvation history. He gives a whole list here of 14 different kinds of ways in which the biblical text is for us a means of, as he puts it, being divinized and uplifted, and he effectively lists all the books of the scriptures. He also describes hymnody or psalmody as a way of being attuned and drawn into the divine harmony and union with God. And I'd invite you to read these texts. You don't need to spend a lot of time with a section on the ecclesiastical hierarchies at the end. It's a little bit complex, but it does give you a sense of how he sees all things in terms of this threefold ordering, which is itself a means of being brought into union with God.